During the history of the last century, most of the major decisions regarding the land of Israel, regarding the partition of Palestine, have been made by outside powers, have been made not by the people who live here, but rather by world powers. And that situation still exists today, where the latest proposition is made by Europe and the United Nations and Russia and the United States, and is to a great extent intended to be imposed upon the people who live in this country. The series of lectures here deal with three attempts earlier to impose some sort of solution. What those attempts were, the people that were involved, and why, to a great extent, those attempts really were unsuccessful. The first that I'm going to deal with tonight deals with the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. There's a wonderful book that was recently published called Paris 1919, 6 Months to Change the World. And it's the story of the Versailles Conference and of the four men who played the leading role, Lloyd George for England and Clemenceau for France, Wilson for the United States, and Orlando for Italy, and of the different personalities and clashes of national interest which occurred. And I think a great deal of this is very relevant to us because we think of Europe or of France or of England, of the BBC and the Independent and the Guardian in England as being creations of the 21st century, when in reality they reflect a position that was very strong in England 80, 90 years ago. We think of France as being France, but France was always France. And the pressures, therefore, on the people of Israel, and the pressures on the Arabs as well, are of long standing. They didn't begin today. And I think that if we see it in that historic backdrop, we can see that this current roadmap or whatever plan is advanced is really only part of a continual chain of the attempt of outside powers to somehow impose a settlement on very reluctant participants here in this part of the world. The hero, as far as the Zionist movement is concerned, in the story of 1919 is Chaim Weizmann. Weizmann has never received his due in the state of Israel because Ben-Gurion didn't allow him to have it. But Weizmann is really the architect of the Jewish national home, of the Jewish state in the land of Israel. Weizmann is a Jew from Pinsk, from Motala. He receives a traditional Jewish education. He is an observant Jew until he's about 17. He then leaves for Germany. In Germany, he becomes secularized, but he doesn't become de-Judaized. And in fact, at the end of his life, he returned to become an observant Jew. Weizmann is a very complicated person, as all of us are. The greater we are, the more complicated we are. Take it from me. And Weizmann, he was described as a well-fed Lenin. He looked like Lenin. He was bald and had a goatee. But he was a much bigger person than Lenin. And he certainly was as devoted to his cause as Lenin was to his cause. However, Weizmann did not use Lenin's tactics and ruthlessness to achieve it. Weizmann becomes a chemist. Not the world's greatest chemist, but a chemist. And eventually, he moves from Germany, because he found German Jews very distasteful. They were far too assimilated for him. He regretted the fact that they saw themselves as Germans overseeing themselves as Jews. He was almost prescient regarding the fact that German Jewry would pay a terrible price for their assimilation. And he moves to England, and he becomes a reader that's like an assistant professor. It's not a fool professor. Yeah, but he said that he's not even a professor. He objected to the fact that he didn't receive the recognition that he should have in a university outside of Manchester. And in as early as 1906, he already meets Balfour, who then is the Prime Minister of England. And Balfour is one of the most complicated, again, people in this story. Balfour was a bachelor. He never married. He was an English aristocrat. He was one of the wealthiest men in England. His father left him a fortune. He was very conversant with the Bible. He had a great belief in religion. But he was very well known for not being a doer. Winston Churchill said that if you want nothing done, Balfour's your man. And Balfour was an exceptional speaker. He and Churchill were the two main orators in the House of Commons. And Churchill once asked him what his secret was of oratory. He said, "I say what I have in mind, and I sit down after the first grammatical sentence." to put it mildly, Weizmann and Balfour are an odd couple, very unlikely to be friends. Now, Balfour is related to the famous Cecil family in England. The Cecils were, from the time of Queen Elizabeth, were the nobility of England, always served in the government, always held positions of high importance, always were people of influence. And this little Jew from Ottele, who, as he himself described, he says, not even being a professor in a medium-rate college in England, is able to insinuate himself into English upper society. And he's able somehow to make friends with people who are very, very powerful and are influential. His entire passion in life, Weizmann's, was Zionism. And he envisioned the creation of a Jewish national homeland in the land of Israel. But he was not very well accepted by English Jewry. For most of English Jewry, he was too Russian. And for the Russian immigrant generation, he was too English. And in the Zionist movement itself, he had very, very many opponents. But he was the only person that had these connections. He was the only one that had entree to world leaders. And because of that, the other members of the Zionist committee had to, so to speak, get along with him. Even though most of the time they didn't agree with his policies, and they also found his personality difficult to deal with. Here in the land of Israel itself, there grew up a different group of leaders. Socialists, Weizmann was a semi-socialist. But here there were full socialists, left-wing socialists, Marxists, that eventually took over the Zionist movement, and they were the main powers in the country. And they felt that Weizmann was not strong enough on socialism, not strong enough on Zionism, and therefore they developed a parallel leadership of the Zionist movement. So you had a world Zionist movement, which was led by Weizmann, but you had a local Zionist movement actually on the ground here in the land of Israel, which was led by the Histadrut and by Ben-Gurion, and that was a completely different group of people with different ideas, to a certain extent different goals. The First World War breaks out. Now, in the First World War, the Jews fought on both sides. There were Jews in the Austrian and German armies. There were Jews in the English, French, and Russian armies. The question was, who would the Jews support in the war? Now, one of the myths that constantly exists is that Jews, who the Jews support somehow is very important. It can, in fact, be the make or break in the war. Why people believe that, it's hard to fathom. A lot of it is because of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which the world believes no matter how many times we deny it. Everyone thinks that there's a committee of Jews, of which I am a member, that sit down once a month and decide the fate of humanity. And as preposterous as that scheme is, it nevertheless is accepted in vast areas of the world as being true, and to a certain extent, it's accepted even by political leaders and leaders of countries who certainly should know better. And because of that, therefore, there was a great sentiment of Jews that supported originally Germany in the war because of their hatred to the Tsar of Russia. The Tsar of Russia and the Russian government was bitterly anti-Semitic. The Jews suffered terribly for the entire 19th century under the hand of the Romanovs, the Russian Tsars, and therefore there was a natural inclination that they wanted to see the Tsar defeated. They wanted to see his government brought down. The Russian government compounded that by anti-Jewish decrees in the war. They made almost 500,000 Jews refugees, forced them to move out of Lithuania and eastern Poland, and sent them deep into Russia. And because of that, therefore, the underlying feeling was that somehow the Jews supported Germany. England was afraid of that. And because England was afraid of that, Weizmann had a lever. And the lever was that if England would come out in favor of the Zionist movement, the Jews would certainly support the Allies. Now, for propaganda purposes, France also agreed that if they could get Jewish support, somehow that would help the war cause. And therefore, France took a very pro-Jewish, official pro-Jewish line, against any anti-Semitism, even though France had not yet recovered from the Dreyfus Affair, and it still has until today. And you had this atmosphere regarding who the Jews would support. The Jews didn't even realize this, right? I mean, if you asked, a Jew in, between Mincha Ma'ariv what he thought about the war, right? So, no one thought in those terms, but somehow in the official circles of the British government and the British Foreign Office, this was part of the consideration. Also, there was the belief, and that was correct, England was bled dry by the First World War. It had to borrow money in order to finance it. It borrowed money in the United States. Many of the offerings of the British government, bonds, etc., were floated by Jewish concerns on Wall Street. And it's interesting that in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, the Japanese had to borrow money, and they were financed by Jacob Schiff, by Bear Stearns and Company, by Seligman and Company, the Jewish bankers who really were against Russia because of the Tsar, and they helped the Japanese win the war. And since that was 1905, and this is 1914, it's a short period of time, it's not even the blink of an eye as far as history is concerned. So that was uppermost also in their minds, that the Jewish money, quote unquote, even though there was much more non-Jewish money in the world, there still is, but that the Jewish money had to somehow support the Allies because the bankers were also floating German bonds at the same time and Austro-Hungarian bonds at the same time. So therefore, Weizmann had this lever of this belief of Jewish influence and power. The second lever that he had was a personal one. The British, no one estimated correctly what the cost of the First World War would be in lives, in time, in money. Everyone thought it was going to be a short, brisk war, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. Then they said 6 months. No one saw it stretching longer than 4 years. No one saw that 20 million men would be killed. No one saw what that every empire would be destroyed by it. No one realizes the consequences of this struggle. One of the things was that they expended artillery shells at an enormous rate. In the Battle of Ypres, more than 1 million artillery shells were fired by the British, all to no avail. Now, to make artillery shells operate correctly, you needed a chemical compound called acetone, because otherwise the shell would not explode at the right height. And if the shell doesn't explode at the right height and just buries itself in the ground like a cannonball, it really has minimal effect. And the British didn't have a method for mass production of acetone. Weizmann, for some reason or other, and this entire lecture has nothing to do with God or religion. I'm leaving it out of the mix completely, though everyone can reinsert it at the proper time when they think about it. He figured out a way to synthetically produce acetone in great quantities. And he gave this patent to the British government without charge, though he could have become a multimillionaire from it. And he gave it to them without charge, and he said, I have no personal desire, no personal favors to ask. My only favor is that you look at the Jewish people favorably and at the cause of the Zionist movement, and that you help advance it. Now, neither the Jewish money nor this magnanimous gesture by Weizmann would have been enough to affect British policy if it were not that British policy and the Zionist movement came close to each other at the end of 1916 and beginning of 1917 because of the length of the war. And what happened was that England and France had a secret treaty called the Sykes-Picot Treaty, in which they divided up the Middle East between themselves. But of course, not having occupied the Middle East, that was a problem. But you have to have the mindset of imperialism before imperialism became a bad word. Today, the communist world made imperialism into a pejorative term, into a negative word. So nobody today is an imperialist. But imperialism in the 19th century was a positive term. And it was the advance of civilization. It was how we were going to teach the poor natives how to govern themselves, how to have health and hospitals and laws and courts and an economy. And imperialism and colonialism went hand in hand, and they were both seen as progressive, a means of educating the world, of bringing everyone up to European standards. And in this treaty, the Sykes-Picot Treaty, it was agreed that France would have what is today Lebanon and Syria, and that England would have what is today Iraq and Palestine, which then included what is today Jordan as well, because England needed to protect its interest in the Suez Canal in Egypt, and therefore it needed all the territory coming south to the Sinai Desert, to Egypt, as a buffer in order to protect its interest in the Suez Canal, which in turn protects the English interest in India. England never imagined giving up India. It was the jewel in the Empress's crown. And therefore, this was all part of the real politic of the time. France saw itself from the time of the Crusades onwards as the protector of Christian interests in the Middle East. That's how France sees itself. And even though today there are very few Christian interests left in the Middle East, but France sees itself as a major player, even though realistically it is very peripheral to anything that goes on here. And the treaty, therefore, between France and England became the basis of what the division would be in the Middle East. At the beginning of 1917, the war turned very badly against the Allies. The German submarine warfare almost brought England to its knees. England was dependent upon imports of everything, of food and coal and of munitions. Everything had to be imported. England couldn't support itself in the war. And here you had now unlimited submarine warfare. The English blockaded Germany, so Germany was half starving, but England was also half starving. And England was afraid all of the major offensives on the Western Front had turned into nothing, into just bloodbaths. So England came up it was Churchill's idea originally, to try and win the war by coming in the Middle East, by knocking Turkey out of the war. Turkey was the ally of Germany and of Austria. The Ottoman Empire was called the sick man of Europe. It was corrupt. They thought that would be an easy way to get out. And England sent an expeditionary force to the Middle East under General Allenby. I think every major city in Israel has an Allenby Street, named after Major Allenby, after Major General Allenby. And the British attempted to unseat the Turks from the Middle East. They had two allies. They had the Arabs and they had the Jews, both of whom wanted to get rid of Turkey. It was obvious to the Zionist movement that as long as the Ottoman Empire ruled Palestine, there never would be a Jewish homeland because the Muslims would not agree to it. And therefore, it was necessary somehow to eliminate Muslim control of the country. The Arabs were being exploited terribly by the Ottomans, by the Turks. The Arabs wanted to have their own countries, their own nationalism. They wanted to have their own freedom, so to speak, something which they have never achieved. And because of that, therefore, you had these two forces, both of which were against Turkey. England played on both of them at the same time. Because when you're in desperation and you have to win the war, you do what you have to do now without realizing what the consequences will necessarily be later. So they made conflicting promises to both sides. Now, in what is today Saudi Arabia, then it was ruled by the Hashemite family. The Saudis, the Saud family, didn't take over until 1923, when they destroyed the Hashemites and drove them out, and the Saudis made an alliance with the Wahhabi Muslims in order to take over the country, and that's how this extreme form of fundamentalist Islam came to control the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. And also, no one knew then that there was oil. Then it was worthless. It was just sand. Sand in Mecca. In fact, the main income of the country was the tourism of the Muslim pilgrims to Mecca. And then all of a sudden, they discovered that 40% of the world's oil reserves lie under those sands. And that changed the whole picture completely. Now, what would have been had the Hashemites continued? There are a lot of what could have beens here in history. What could have been had the Hashemites continued to rule? Who knows? But the Saudis came to rule. In any event, Hussein, who was the sheriff of Mecca, the head of the Hashemites, and his son Faisal, and Faisal was really the head of the Arabs, mounted a rebellion against the Turks, and it's the famous story of Lawrence of Arabia, etc. So they attacked the Turks. The Jews here in the land of Israel, the Turks persecuted them terribly. Most of the Zionist leaders were driven out of the country. Ben-Gurion spent the war in the United States, in New York. Ben-Tzvi, they were all driven out of the country. But there were Jewish organizations here also that opposed the Turks, spied for the British. Eventually, Weizmann put enormous pressure on Balfour, and Balfour convinced the British government to issue a declaration on behalf of Zionism. Now, Balfour was opposed in the English cabinet by a Jew by the name of Montague. And Montague said very openly, he said that, I cannot conceive a worse bondage to which to relegate an advanced and intellectual community such as England as the support of Zionism. He asked, what is to become of the people of the country? He said, it is a mischievous political creed untenable by any patriotic citizen of the United Kingdom. It was because of Montague that the Balfour Declaration was watered down, because originally it was a much stronger statement in support of Zionism and in support of Jewish rights in the country. Weizmann's answer to this, very strange answer, they asked him, well, what is your right to the country? And he said, our right to the country is memory, which made an impression on Lloyd George. Lloyd George said later that he knew all the names of all the kings of Israel, but he knew none of the names of the kings of Wales. And he said, and they had a strange religious attachment to the country. And they saw it as being somehow a noble deed that would survive them. Balfour, on his deathbed, said that the Balfour Declaration was the noblest thing that he ever did in his life. And it's interesting that Balfour is practically remembered by no one except the Jews. If it would not have been for the Balfour Declaration. Someone pointed out to me that there were more streets in Israel named Balfour than in England. So in 1917, the Balfour Declaration is proclaimed. The Balfour Declaration says that we support a Jewish national homeland in Palestine and will do everything possible to facilitate it without prejudicing the rights of the non-Jewish population. Now, how do you make a Jewish national homeland without prejudicing the rights of the other people who are not Jews? No one explained that. And the Balfour Declaration was immediately rejected by all of the Arabs, all of the Muslims, as being completely unacceptable, and that they would never abide by its rules or by its tenets. But Weizmann saw it as a tremendous triumph, which it was. And Weizmann's belief was that a Jewish national homeland could be built here in the country, but that there was no necessity to build a Jewish state. In other words, it would be an the country would belong to England. England would be the fence, it would be the foreign policy, it would be the economy, it would be governed by the British, but that there would be an autonomous Jewish society in the country that would be able to develop, etc., etc. And his idea was that the state was a long time in coming. He talked in terms of centuries. Now, all of this was changed naturally by the Holocaust, which no one saw coming at all. And we'll discuss that in the next lecture when we discuss what happened in 47. But here we're in 1919. Now, in the peace conference, every little group in the world came before the peace conference and advanced its claim to being a nation. Part of the problem was that Woodrow Wilson, in his 14 points, stressed the idea of self-determination, meaning that every group of people had a right to decide for themselves where they were going to live and under which government. All of the countries in Europe had minorities. All of the minorities came forth and said, we don't want to be a minority, we don't want to be part of Austria, we don't want to be part of Hungary, we don't want to be part of Romania, we want to be a country by ourselves. Well, if you did that, there'd be 80 little countries in Europe. And therefore, this concept of self-determination ran into the reality of nations, how they exist. So they tried to find the balance. Czechoslovakia, for instance, they created a new country. And they put together two people who didn't like each other, the Czechs and the Slovaks. So and today we see that they have separated into two separate countries. But during the peace conference, they were very adamant that the Czechoslovakian entity be created. Benesh, Masaryk, all of the Czechs represented it. And the Slovaks wanted to be separate, but they said the countries couldn't exist separate. They forced them together, and they created that country. In Poland, you had the tremendous problem of minorities. And so the Poles had to agree, in order to have an independent Poland, that they would respect all of the rights and religions and everything of the minorities in Poland. Well, naturally, when it came to the Jews, that was not enforced, and Poland between the wars was terribly anti-Semitic on an official basis. Into this, but they kept on coming, all the people in the Balkans. So we have all of that today. We have Kosovo and Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Serbia, and Croatia, and Slovenia, all of that, they all came to this peace conference. They all said, we want to be our own. And the power politics of the time, so they forced them all together into Yugoslavia, which was the southern Slavs, dominated mainly by Serbia. But you had a lot of Muslims there, and the Serbians were Orthodox Christians, and you had a lot of Roman Catholics. It was a formula destined for trouble. And as long as there were dictators in the country, so the dictators held it together. The moment Tito and everybody else fell apart, so then we saw a decade of wars, and the fact that there are still American troops in the former Yugoslavia to keep people from killing each other. Into this mix walked the Zionist movement. And they say, we want Palestine. Palestine is ours. And they were supported by Britain because of the Balfour Declaration. And they were opposed by France. France opposed from the beginning. And so then the question was, who was going to have the mandate over Palestine? And France was determined to block Britain. And in blocking Britain, they had to block the Zionists. So at this commission, many groups of Jews came to testify. So the Zionist movement marshaled all of its forces. It was Sishkin who testified in Hebrew, and Nochem Sokolov, and Weizmann, and all of the leading Zionists, Brandeis. But there also were the anti-Zionists who came to testify. The Orthodox anti-Zionists came to testify against, and the assimilated Jews came. You know, politics means very strange bedfellows. The assimilated Jews came and testified against, and France insisted that there be two French Jews who would speak. One was André Spire, who was a poet and a leading figure in French Jewry, and Sylvain Lévy, who was a distinguished scholar in a French university. And they were told by the French government, we are anxious to have a French Zionist make a statement which can be construed as being favorable to Zionism, but you should try to make it clear that France must have Palestine. Spire made a half-hearted statement, but Lévy came out openly, and he said, as a Frenchman of Jewish origin, he said the results of enforcing the Balfour Declaration would be disastrous. Weizmann shouted to him in French, I read the English translation, I no longer know you, you are a traitor. But he only raised the same problems that Montague had raised before. The English, however, interestingly enough, were unmoved by all of this. Because of their power politics also, they wanted France excluded from that area. And they saw the Zionist movement as their lever against France, as being able somehow to prevent the French from having the mandate. And therefore, Balfour said, when the Arab delegation came, and protested it, so he said, the Arabs are ungrateful people. They're accused of ingratitude. He said, look at all we're giving them. We're giving them the whole Middle East. We freed them from Turkey. And his statement was, I hope, remembering all that we have done for you, which is very patronizing, as you can imagine, you will not begrudge that small notch of land. For it is no more geographically than a notch, whatever it may be historically. That small notch is what we are now taking from the Arab territories and giving to the people who for all these hundreds of years have been separated from it. The Arabs didn't take kindly to that statement. They did not see it as a small notch of land. They did not see it as being ungrateful. And they saw it as England somehow pursuing its imperialistic goals in the guise of Zionism, something which remains until today. If you hear what the Muslims keep on saying, you know, Israel's the small Satan, America's the great Satan, Israel is just the cat's paw in the door. It's really the West that is trying to take over. They want to take our oil, they want to take our culture, etc., etc. So that's what they said in 1919 at the Paris Peace Conference. Weizmann made a gracious speech. He said there is room for both sides to work side by side. Be careful of mischievous insinuations that Zionists are seeking political power. Rather, let both peoples progress together until we are ready for joint autonomy. Now, there was a split in the Zionist movement. There were many that held that the country should be a federal type of a government. It should be Jews and Arabs together. There should not be a separate Jewish state. There should not be a separate Arab state. But that together, Magnus, who was the president of Hebrew University, and others supported that idea. It still exists. It floats in the air every so often now also, that somehow that would be a solution to the problem. Weizmann met with Faisal. Now, Faisal was given the Iraq as his reward. And Faisal and Weizmann got along fabulously. Weizmann said, however, that Faisal is contemptuous of the Palestinian Arabs, whom he doesn't even regard as legitimate Arabs. So this is in the inter-Arab struggle, which still exists today, the attitude of the other Arab countries towards the Palestinian Arabs. He said to Weizmann, it is curious that there should be any friction between Jews and Arabs. After all, there is plenty of land to go around. Weizmann and Faisal made an agreement that they would live together in peace, but the agreement never came into being because of the problems between Britain and France and between the Jews and the Arabs. And the final recommendation of the commission was to appoint another commission which would study the matter, because all of a sudden they realized that they had an intractable problem here. Two Americans were appointed to the commission, Charles Crane and Henry King. They were both businessmen. One was a businessman and one was a professor. And they came out emphatically against the entire Zionist program. And they recommended that the peace conference limit Jewish immigration and give up completely on the idea of making Palestine a Jewish homeland. England and Woodrow Wilson ignored their recommendation. But here you have already in 1919 the basis of the Arabist position of much of the State Department, that the world would be better off without a Zionist presence, without a State of Israel, because it's a problem that cannot be solved. The border, England did a clever thing then. They diverted the conversation as to where the borders of Palestine should be. Now, here is really the crux of the issue. Is the Zionist movement and the creation of the State of Israel, is that an existential issue? Meaning, does it have a right to exist? Or is it only a territorial issue? It has a right to exist. The question is, how much territory should it have? England jumped the gun and said, it's a territorial issue. We're going to negotiate now with France where the border should be. England said it should include much of what is Syria. They drew the border just 4 kilometers south of Damascus. The French naturally had a fit. And they went back to the agreement, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and the border, the international border between Palestine and Syria and Lebanon was as it was in 1948. So the French thought that they won because they won the territorial issue. England felt they won because the existential issue disappeared from the table. Lloyd George said to Weizmann, "Now you have your state. It all depends on you now." And Ben-Gurion paraphrased that in his famous statement, which has not ever been proven true. Ben-Gurion said, "It doesn't matter what the nations of the world say, it matters only what the Jewish people do." So that sounds good, but it doesn't resonate in the reality of the world. Now, this peace conference therefore granted England the mandate. The British Foreign Office, by that time, was taken over by Lord Curzon, and he said, "Personally, I am convinced that Palestine will be a rankling thorn in the flesh of whoever is charged with the mandate, and therefore I would withdraw from this responsibility while we yet can." Churchill said, "Palestine is costing us £6 million a year to hold. The Zionist movement will cause continued friction with the Arabs. The French ensconced in Syria were paid for by not paying what they owe us, are opposed to the Zionist movement and will try to cushion the Arabs off onto us as being the real enemy. We should get out." In spite of all of this advice, England did not get out. But England accepted upon itself the mandate, for whatever reasons. And by accepting the mandate, they entered into what were 25 years of constant strife. The Arabs simply repeated that they refused to recognize the Balfour Declaration, the British mandate, and refused to obey any of its orders. Churchill winked at the Zionist movement and he said, "We won't mind it if you set up a Zionist governing body, but don't speak of it." All agreed that the Palestinian Arab delegation was a nuisance. Lloyd George suggested cheerfully, "Why not bribe them?" The Prime Minister was full of helpful ideas. He told Balfour to make a big speech again in Albert Hall in London, approving of Zionism. In July 1922, the League of Nations approved the British mandate. As part of approving the British mandate, they also adopted the Balfour Declaration as being, and therefore the mandate was to bring both the Jews and the Arabs to such a state of civilization that they would be able to have their own government and their own state. The mandate was not meant to last forever, but in the mind of England, it was going to last forever. England never thought of it as being temporary. Weizmann said to Ben-Gurion, who objected to this, Ben-Gurion was, from the beginning, he said that England would not be our salvation. Weizmann said to him, "If only we go on working and working in Palestine, then the time will come when there will be another opportunity of giving the mandate its true value." That time came when England resigned from the mandate, but that would take Hitler and the Second World War to accomplish it. So, in effect, if we look back, the year 2003 is not so different than the year 1919. and the basic problem that the Arabs did not accept the mandate brought it back to an existential problem and not a territorial problem. And because it remains an existential problem, or in the minds of the Israelis, in our minds, it remains an existential problem. And if you listen to the Arab propaganda, that type of understanding is reinforced. So then there's nothing to talk about the territorial problem, because what difference does it make? And the assumptions that England made, that somehow Faisal and Weizmann got along, so therefore the Jews and the Arabs would get along, that assumption was proven wrong almost from the outset. The Arabs rioted in 1921, 1924, 1927, 1929, 1933, 1936, and 1939. So, you know, to have an intifada should not be a surprise. It happens every few years. Except the English put it down with enormous force and without television cameras following them, and a different mindset in the world regarding all of these things. But the English became convinced that the Zionists were a problem. So England would change its policy 180 degrees. By 1948, when we have tomorrow's brilliant lecture, so we'll see that England supported the Arabs wholeheartedly and was completely against the Zionist venture, and offered, in fact, to evacuate the Jews. Because they said otherwise the Jews would be destroyed. So this attempt in 1919 you have to remember also that in 1919 there were 700,000 people in the country. Out of the 700,000, 560,000 were Arabs. So you had at most 140,000 Jews in the country at the beginning of the mandate. And yet, it was like supposed to be even between the Jews and the Arabs. And as a practical matter, the Jews were more than the Arabs in terms of power, in terms of government, in terms of influence, in terms of the economy, in terms of the entire development of the country. So as we have seen throughout the world, the Jews were disproportionate in the country to their population. But not only disproportionate, they gave the impression that somehow there were 10 million Jews here in the country, and that therefore they could do whatever they wanted to do. This rankled, as you can well imagine, the Arabs. And England tried to appease them. They appointed the Grand Mufti. They did all sorts of things to try and appease the Arabs. They limited Jewish immigration. But none of that changed the facts on the ground in the country. And the facts on the ground in the country was that Tel Aviv developed and the New Jerusalem developed, and there were always new settlements and new outposts, and the Jews kept on pushing and pushing, and the Arabs resented every step of the way. And they resented it in the only way that they could, in violence. Once you had violence, so then the Jewish defense organizations occurred. The entire dynamic that we see today built up already, and it became almost a self-fulfilling prophecy for both sides as to what was going to happen. Looking back at 1919, it's easy to second-guess all of the people at the Versailles Conference. Most of the time they come in for terrible criticism because 20 years later the world was at war again, in a worse war, in a more fearsome battle that took many more lives. And so therefore they're looked at as a failure. But I think on the whole, if you look at it, they had very few choices. They had terrible problems. They had very few choices, very few options. They tried to do the best they could. But as in most matters, we learned today in Pirkei Avos, Ezeu Chochem, who's the wise man. So the rabbis gave one answer, a roes anolad, to be able to see the consequences, the future. since we're not blessed with prophecy, so no one sees that. We see imperfect hindsight, so we see that maybe the agreements in 1993 were not such good ideas. Maybe the Lebanese war, maybe this, maybe that. But that's all perfect hindsight. But when you're on the ground and you have to make decisions, so then things are not that clear. So in 1919, it wasn't clear to them either. They thought they did a noble thing. They thought they did the right thing. They thought that this would somehow bring stability and peace to the Middle East, something which the great powers have always sought to do. But as we see that the outside forces have been unable until now, at least, to be able to effectuate in that fashion. So that's the beginning of the story, 1919. Tomorrow we'll go to 1947 and 1948, and we'll see how the outside forces then changed, but how the results were pretty much the same. Thanks.